And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from the seaport, whatever, in New York City, where I was not planning to do a podcast today. But when Stan Van Gundy is in New York and says, yes, I will make the mistake of coming on your podcast, you say, let's do it. So, Stan, Coach, how are you doing?
I'm good and glad to be here with you. You're one of the few that I would have actually done this for. So, you know, because that's an hour into my afternoon nap time now, which is an unemployed coach. I try to be a regular at.
You need a nap, and today you need a nap because you're on get-up duty today.
Well, yeah, and the games, they just go so long. I mean, you know, you're up at 1 in the morning watching those West Coast games, man.
You don't want to know what my plan for tonight is? Because we're now like 16 days into the playoffs, which means I'm like 16 times 3, whatever it is, like 48 hours bereft of sleep. If I'm sleeping 5 hours a night. So tonight there's only one game, Nuggets, Blazers. That's it, one game. I'm watching the first. This is what I'm going to tell myself now, and then I'm going to violate it. So I'm going to try and speak it into existence like LeVar Ball. I'm going to watch the first half, and then I'm going to bed at 10 and get my 8 hours of sleep. That's my goal.
Well, see, I think that's great. And I've tried to do a lot of times what I'll do is record the games, and I'll just get up and watch them the next morning. But when you've got to be here at 6 in the morning and you're on the road, it's a little harder to record them anyway. And so you got to stay up and watch them. And it's, man, those West Coast games are late.
They're late. East Coast is it's the toughest time zone, I think. It has its plus, but on the West Coast, the games are starting so earlier. I'm still working. I'm not ready for this.
That's true. When I've been out there doing NBA countdown, you know, and you've got to go to the studio at 3 o'clock to be on the show. You're like, it's the middle of the afternoon. Yeah. Like, what are we at, an AAU tournament? I mean, what's going on?
Let's talk playoffs. Let's talk mostly about the two games that were last night because, you know, there's no sense talking Nuggets, Blazers. That's going to start very soon. So Bucks, Celtics, Warriors, Rockets. You have been staunchly the field in the Warriors versus – that's staunchly, but Warriors versus the field. I have been Warriors all season. I wavered. I started to quake when they lost that second game to the Clippers. I thought, this just isn't right. This team shouldn't lose. Now I'm starting to feel better about life. They're up 2-0 in one of the tough series that's going to be – on their path to a title, if they get that far. What is Houston having issues with? Where do you see them being able to rebound other than going home in game three? What can they do to get on the right side of these?
Well, I mean, you just said it, rebound. I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, to me, the two biggest factors in game two, you know, people get so carried away a lot of times with schemes and adjustments and, you know, all of those things. And then you watch last night and you say, okay, you gave the Warriors 18 offensive rebounds. This is a team that's not known as an offensive rebounding juggernaut. 18 offensive rebounds. And then Houston turns the ball over 17 times to Golden State's 12. The result of all that is 14 more shots for the Warriors. Now, that negated what Houston was able to do from three-point range. So field goal percentage is basically identical. Free throws basically identical. Houston shoots the three a lot better, but Golden State gets 14 more shots. That was the difference in the game. And so I had a great assistant coach who's now with Billy Donovan in Oklahoma City, Bob Beyer. And every time I would start getting into all of the adjustments and schemes and all of that, would every time in our coaches meeting would say, that's all well and good. And he'd bring it right back to things like that. But we've got to block out and rebound. We got to run back on defense. We got to take care of the ball. Like, and that's really, if we get to it in basketball, it comes down to those fundamental things more times than it comes down to any great chess move you make as a coach.
To your point, the Warriors for the series have rebounded 34.4% of their own misses, which would lead the league by a mile. And you just can't beat them. You cannot beat them giving them extra stuff. You're just not going
to
beat them.
No. You know, one of the things that we used to always talk about, Zach, was you never want to give people second chances. But when you're playing the great shooting teams and you get them to miss, you have to come up with the ball. And offensive rebounding has been something that has virtually disappeared from our game. I know you've talked about it over the years. My brother talks about it all the time. And you sort of wonder from a coaching angle, if you shouldn't make it more of a point of emphasis. And then you've got to figure out your transition defense from there. And you certainly saw the value of it last night with the Warriors. And you're right. Look, I remember coming in the league in the mid-90s being an assistant to Pat Riley. And, I mean, one year the Bulls were around 40% off the offensive glass. Ooh. They had that great movement out of the triangle, which really lent itself to offensive rebounding and on the move. And now you lead the league under 30%. Under 30%,
yeah,
to lead the league. And then last night, it's startling to watch somebody get that many offensive rebounds in today's NBA.
Well, and clearly to your point about maybe there's some low-hanging fruit where if we can figure out a way to do it without compromising our transition defense, clearly the Warriors have given – I mean, he's a bit player, but they've given McKinney permission. You go crash. You're good at it. You're going to be guarded by guys who just like – these guards aren't used to like having a little 6'7" wing, not little, but come in and crash the hell out of the glass. And I think, I don't want to talk too much about this series, but the Sixers are very interesting to watch in this regard because they've gone all in on size. They're huge at almost every position. And just, you can see sometimes like they'll have the corner guy. Ennis is really good at this. He'll come in, he'll go from the corner into the paint, like just in case. And it, when the ball hits the rim, he'll make a judgment. Do I have a chance? Yes, I'm going in. No, I'm now curling back on defense. And he's actually snuck in for some offensive rebounds like that. And to your point about transition defense, like finding the value of being big is so interesting to me. Again, Philly is huge. And if you look at their numbers, they give up like the second or third most transition opportunities in the league, probably because they crash the glass and people try to run. But they're like number two in points per possession allowed on transition opportunities, and I think it's because they're just giant. If they get back in the picture, they can disrupt you.
Well, I think there's a couple of things, right? I think for Golden State, I think they can go to the glass really hard in this series because we know how slow Houston plays. So Houston's not looking to run the ball up the floor. And I think in general, Zach, as you know, the playoffs tend to slow down. People really aren't looking to run as much. And so having an offensive rebound emphasis makes a lot of sense. And clearly, this didn't happen by chance. Clearly, Steve Kerr and the Warriors have an offensive rebounding emphasis, and it makes a lot of sense, yeah, especially against Houston, which is a team that is not going to run the ball. Now, against most teams, if you're going to go to the boards, what it's going to require is tremendous effort from the players. So if you watch what Boston's doing to Milwaukee, and I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves.
Go.
But they're doing a great job of getting back. They're back early. And especially Al Horford's getting back. And so they're building a wall on Giannis. Not quite as well last night as they did in game one, but they're doing the best job I've seen anybody do against Milwaukee this year of getting back, getting their defense set. To do that, they're not going to the offensive glass.
Right.
Okay. If you're going to go to the offensive glass and get back, there's a demand on your players for extreme effort. It's easy to get back early. I can jog back as the ball goes up, and I'm going to be set. If I'm going to go to the glass and the other team gets the ball, I got to be on a dead-end sprint to get back and in position. It's harder to do.
So, I, again, not to get ahead of ourselves, but you mentioned Horford. You're too smart to read a lot of Twitter commentary and, like, sort of intentionally flammable media commentary. The next time Al Horford has like three straight games where he scores 11 points, there's going to be this, oh, they used to, like, he was a average Al. Why are we giving this guy a max contract? He only gets 11. Why can't he give him? I don't want to hear that anymore. This dude, this matchup against Milwaukee and what he's done to Giannis, now it's 1-1. It's not like they've dominated. They just got destroyed last night. This is like, it doesn't matter if he scores 15 points in a game. He's impacting the entire chance that Boston has to win this series is because of Al Horford on both ends of the floor.
You know what? That's exactly right. I mean, look, this is the main reason Boston has won both last year and this year is they're an elite level defense. Everybody talks about the talent they have. This hasn't been a great offensive team, as you know.
Even in the first round, they were not
right,
good offensively.
Not at all. I think right now in the playoffs, they're the least efficient offensive team in the postseason of the teams that are left. A lot of the teams that got knocked out certainly were less efficient. They've won because they're an elite level defense, and the anchor of that defense is Al Horford. His ability to guard a guy like Giannis off the dribble and to defend his own guy in the post and to guard pick and rolls, however you want to guard it, and to switch on to guards. You know, you had the really big play, in the one game in the first round, right? Where he got switched on to Bogdanović late.
Yes.
And Bogdanović isolates and drives him to his left hand. And Horford gets the block. They get out on the break, and Jaylen Brown gets it to Tatum, I think, for the three to go ahead and win it. I mean, Al Horford, if anything, is still to this day one of the more underrated players in the league.
I'm telling you, if the Celtics are alive long enough, he'll get 36 points in three games, and the average Al, he doesn't get us enough play. It'll all come out again. Anyway, so the rebounding. The Warriors through two games, 114 point something points per 100 possessions. That would lead the league. However, to your point, I think Houston's half-court defense has actually been good enough to win this series, good enough to win these games. Their half-court first-shot defense, I think, has been largely fine. Like, you're not going to go – there'll be blips where, yeah, they miss a switch on Clay or Capella gets hung up on a screen or this and that. It's the Warriors. Like, they run a lot of stuff. You're going to mess up. It's the rebounds and the turnovers. Their first shot defense, I actually think, has been pretty solid.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. And again, you just, as we said earlier, and not to, you know, beat the horse to death, but you can't play the Golden State Warriors and give them 18 offensive rebounds and that many more chances at it. No, they've done a pretty solid job on the defensive end. I think the one thing that is interesting in that series, and you go back to the huge three in game one that Curry made against Nene.
Yeah.
And Houston's a team that basically switches everything. And it's really interesting to me the contrast between Houston and Milwaukee defensively. So Houston has basically switched everything all year long. You sort of wonder if that switch is something they really should be doing against Golden State. I mean, their centers really got destroyed in game one trying to play those guys. They give them space. They give up threes. But when you've switched all year long, right, it's virtually impossible now to think that your guards, who haven't had to do it all year, are all of a sudden going to get over picks. That's not going to happen. And then you look at Milwaukee, who switched about as little as anybody during the season. Right, are the two that didn't switch. And then last night, you see Mike Budenholzer's adjustment, and they switched more than I've seen him switch all year.
Ever.
Right. But that's an easier adjustment. You can go that way. It's really hard if Jeff Bezdelic and Mike D'Antoni decide, boy, we really don't want Nene, especially, having to switch out onto Steph Curry. Well, what are you going to tell your guards? Get over a pick for the first damn time all year where all you've done is gone under and caught the roll, man? That's hard to do. When you play the way Mike Budenholzer has played, had Milwaukee play all year, that adjustment's open to you in the playoffs.
So I found it very intriguing, very interesting, that in the second half last night, Houston put Harden on Durant and Tucker on Iguodala. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, that's weird. That's, you know, voluntarily putting James Harden on Kevin Durant is not something that you think of. He's a pretty tough guy in the post. That's well documented. You can't move him. You know, KD can shoot over him, but KD can shoot over everybody. I didn't see any media commentary about this. Maybe I missed it. My guess was, unless Tucker was in foul trouble, and I'm just forgetting this, I don't think he was. My guess was let PJ roam a little bit as a help defender. He's the best one we've got, particularly when we take Capella off the floor. We got to talk about Capella in a second. And what you saw was, so that makes sense, right? But what you saw in a bunch of plays was like the inherent tension between switching and helping. So there was one play in the third quarter, Steph Draymond pick and roll. Draymond slips the screen. He gets behind the defense. It's now PJ Tucker's job to go help at the rim. Iguodala's on the weak side. Except Iguodala's setting a little fake pin down for Durant. So PJ Tucker's looking at that like, oh, I got to take care of that. And then Draymond dunks. And they're like, it's having a switch scheme and you're going to be our help defender. Tristan Thompson ran into this too. It's like impossible to do both of them.
Well, no, it is. And look, when you play these great offensive teams, that not only have great players but have great coaches. And you're in a lot of those situations that are really, really difficult. And you've just got to decide. Here's the thing defensively, and probably truer now than it's ever been in the NBA. You can't take everything away. So we know that the most efficient shots, I mean, come on, we've all been schooled in this analytically, all of us around the game, are free throws number one, layups at the rim number two, and threes number three. Well, it's going to be really hard to limit teams in really good teams in all three of those areas. I think the problem that a lot of teams have is they get caught in between and they don't take away anything because you're trying to take away everything. And I think Milwaukee is instructive. There's a lot of ways to play defensively. So I'm not saying you have to play it their way, but they were the number one defense in the league. And it's instructive that in a three-point crazy league, they gave up the most three-point attempts and makes in the league and elected to say, you know what, we're going to take away the paint and we're going to try not to foul because you've got to take away something. Yes.
They were number one at both.
They didn't give up fast break buckets. You know, they took all that stuff away. And I think you could decide, like Detroit was close to the top 10 defensively, and Dwayne sort of went the other way. Dwayne decided, we're going to really try to take away threes, and they gave up stuff at the rim. So I don't think anybody's philosophy is right or wrong, but I do think you're forced to make choices in today's NBA, and I think what you have to do is we've got to take away something. Because if you're trying to take away everything – you end up giving up everything.
So this is. I want to ask you this as a coach. Let's just jump around. All orders going out the window.
Yes,
now.
It is. Yes,
we're talking about.
I'm taking all that away from you. Yes.
Look at my notes.
Master of chaos, right here.
All gone. So they are now. Milwaukee is now facing a pick and roll combination tailor made to hurting that defense.
And it has hurt them already.
Is Al Horford popping for three? And you can see it hurt them in a lot of different ways. They're starting to veer a little bit and switch and get caught in between and blah, blah, blah. Why do you not just run that every time? Like as a coach, I always wonder, like, is there just a line where you run it too much and they adjust in a way that hurts it, or the other players get sort of disengaged from the play? Like if I'm Brad Stevens, I'm running it twice as often as he's done so far in the series. And I'm not Brad Stevens. He's a genius. I'm just a schmuck on a podcast.
No, but it's an interesting question because you are right about Brad. He is a great, great coach. And I think his game plan in this series, particularly at the defensive end, has been absolutely terrific. But I too find myself watching the games and saying, why aren't we just going to high pick and roll with Kyrie and Al Horford, because they've veered back a little bit, but not a lot. For the most part, they've been willing to live with wide open Al Horford threes, and he's knocked them down. And last night in particular, there was an increased emphasis on having a second defender on Kyrie all the time. Their help was earlier. They got somebody between him and the basket, and Brook Lopez was going to stay there on that pick and roll. He was not thinking, get back to Al Horford. They were primarily focused on stopping Kyrie. If you can keep throwing it back to Al Horford and he can keep knocking the ball in, you're going to force an adjustment on Milwaukee's part. You can't switch Brook Lopez onto Kyrie Irving. No, that's not going to work.
That's death.
It's very tough to rotate out of. You can get into some veer backs, but if they get any kind of movement, then you're going to end up with Brook Lopez on one of their perimeter guys somewhere. So I'm with you in that I was a little bit surprised that we didn't see a lot more, quite honestly, of that pick and roll last night.
And I don't even know if it helps them to play Brook Lopez off the floor. That's the tricky thing for me. If they had Brogdon, I would say almost for sure it doesn't, because they have enough small guys to make a pretty good small ball or Giannis at center or whatever lineup. But I don't know. I don't know why Boston is doing that more. And at the same token, I think they should go at Kyrie more. On the other end, I think they should run way more Giannis Bledsoe two-man game. They ran like They did a lot of that two-man game, but oftentimes with Rozier's, man. And I like Rozier's a better defender. I'm not like that worried about Rozier switch. I'm worried about Rozier switching onto Giannis, honestly, but I'm running that stuff at Kyrie until I'm exhausting him. I'm running him through the gauntlet every time.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, you know, for number one, I mean, anytime you can get a hit on those guys, those type of guys,
hit them,
wear on them a little bit also, I think it's good. That's something that we really haven't seen much in the postseason out of Milwaukee is that pick and roll combination. And then the other one that, you know, I've seen very little from them, but is really hard is when you get the guard screening on Giannis.
Yeah.
You know, that's really, really tough. We see a lot of it with Denver, with Murray and Jokic, as a ball handler. Now, I understand it's harder to defend Denver because you can't go under that screen on Jokic. They were trying to do that the other night, and he was hitting threes on it. So it's tougher than it would be on Giannis, but it still forces you into a lot of decisions.
Yeah, that two-man game is really good either direction you do it. And, you know, I just wonder, going back to Horford and the pick and pop, I just wonder when they're going to put Brook Lopez on Marcus Morris and put Giannis on Al Horford. Because even if you don't switch that, even if you're not saying we're doing that to switch, Giannis is just so much faster. He can corral the pick and roll and get back to Horford. And at least that's now a contested three. And Lopez and guard Marcus Morris, fine. Now the Celtics can obviously just take Marcus Morris out of the game.
Now what the Celtics will do is run the pick and roll with Marcus Morris. And you'll be in the same thing. And Morris is a – here's the thing with Morris.
I don't
trust
the Marcus Morris 3-point shooting like I trust.
See, I do, and here's why. Here's the thing. Al won't shoot it every time.
That's what
even if he's open.
That's what Milwaukee is actually basing their defense on.
And that's exactly right. And Marcus will every time. And so no, but I think that's more dangerous.
Really,
when we would prepare for teams, you know, and you would talk about guys as shooters. The low volume, high percentage 3-point shooters were never scary. Like J.R. Smith got to where he wasn't very efficient, but he scared the hell out of you because J.R. Smith could have one of those games where he hits six of them.
Yeah.
Not one, not two. You know, I'm sure Milwaukee's looking at Al Horford. Okay, he's going to hit a couple. No big deal. You put Brook Lopez on Marcus Morris and run the pick and roll with him. He'll shoot it every damn time, and he's got a chance of making five or six of them. So I think when we evaluate 3-point shooters, volume's a big part of it. Now, not volume that's really bad shooting, but like I'd rather have a 35-36% 3-point shooter who's shooting seven a game than a 40% shooter who's shooting three a game.
Sure. And Al, if you give Al, and I think Kyrie, and I think even Jaylen Brown had a couple last night where they were really good at kind of hesitating and then taking one more dribble into the paint and then sometimes around the back passes, but kicking it back to Al. And that one extra dribble gets Lopez an extra 2 feet down. And like Al has, I mean, literally 15 feet of room when he catches the ball. I think he's good. That's got to be a 40 to 45% shot for him. Like he has to take that every time.
But again, he shot it well in the series. But if you and I went back through the film, I think we'd see four or five a game where he's passing up shots. And so you're right. I think Milwaukee banks on that. Like, yeah, Al's a good shooter. And the key point is we've had two blowout games.
Right.
Now, if we've got close games down the stretch, even though Al's not going to make maybe five or six in a game, is Milwaukee going to be willing to live with that minute to go in a tie game?
Right.
You know, minute to go down one and he can take it to down four. I think that'll be the interesting thing. Over the course of the game, I get it. With Al Horford, but we'll see what happens when it's, you know, shots that can decide a game.
And when Lopez is off the floor and Ilyasova is off the floor, Giannis is guarding Horford. And I thought there were a couple of, and even with Lopez on the floor, I thought there were a couple of possessions when, since Morris is guarding Lopez, that matchup carried over to when Boston had the ball and they ran Kyrie Horford, except Giannis is on Horford, and they switched. And obviously that leaves Bledsoe on Horford, which is not good. Giannis on Irving is like, it's like watching someone from a different species guard a normal human being. You can't even see Kyrie. And on those possessions, they very artfully scrammed or they dragged Bledsoe out of that matchup because Mirotić was nearby. So you get out. That looks pretty good to me. Like, if I'm Milwaukee, the number one thing I'm scared of is the Kyrie Horford pick and roll. That's the focus of my, like, how can I make that less dangerous? I thought that looked kind of good. Boston would obviously then see that coming, anticipate it, set up some counters and this and that, but I kind of want to make them go through that motion a little bit more.
Well, yeah, and I thought what was amazing about that is, again, Milwaukee is not a team that switched a lot during the regular season. So to be able to do that, the switch itself, okay, not that hard. But to get into exactly what you're talking about with the scram and getting Bledsoe out of there, that's become second nature to Golden State, Houston, teams like that right. who switch a lot. But to go to this at this point in the year, that's not an easy thing to do. And I was amazed that they were able to do it a couple of times as well as they did. Now, if they had to do it on more high volume, we'll see if they could actually get it done possession after possession after possession.
Here's another coaching question for you. This is relevant in both the Philly-Toronto series and the Milwaukee-Boston one. Baines cannot guard Giannis. I mean, Giannis is not shooting well with Baines on the floor, but I have it in my notes somewhere. I think he has 12 free throws in 18 minutes with Baines. Baines just can't guard him. At what point do you have to start thinking we need to match Horford and Giannis's minutes because we just don't have anyone else that can guard him? And I think Toronto is going to start grappling with the, at what point do we need to have Gasol on the floor whenever Embiid is? Did you ever had a coaching decision where you really had to like dramatically change your rotation so one specific guy could guard another specific guy?
Yeah, look, I where was it for us was last year in the regular season, we tried very hard to match Avery Bradley's minutes to Kyrie's minutes when we played Boston because he could guard him. And, you know, Brad's great with stuff like that because his rotations are, at least in the regular season, are more irregular than just about anybody in the league. You know, like most teams, you can sit down and you'll go into a game and you know when they're going to sub people, not with Brad. And so what he would do is he'd get Kyrie out early and then bring him back. And so we had to just what you said, try to match him. The best one I've seen is when I was an assistant for Riley. This is going way back. And my brother was coaching the Knicks. We had Clarence Weatherspoon in Miami, who'd been a really good player for us off the bench. We played him in a playoff series, ended up losing a game 7 at home. Maybe it was a game 5. I think it was game 7.
All those Heat-Knicks series blend together for me.
Yeah, exactly right. And some of them were 5-game series. But what my brother did is he matched literally every possession. Marcus Camby on Clarence Weatherspoon, and his length was too much for Spoon. Spoon was only 6'7",
yeah,
and
he could like go in
and, yeah, and dominate other people. And I mean, literally, whenever we'd send Spoon to the bench, Camby would go. Like, he didn't even have to ask my brother after a while. He's just coming down into the game. And they took away our best bench player in that series. And so, yeah, those things – that's like people always look for these big schematic things. I think it's more things like that, matchups. And we've already seen teams in the playoffs change their lineup. Steve yeah. Kerr, who never gets enough credit for what he does as a coach because they're so talented, the idea to go small in this series has been huge. You know, you would think that a team like you're the number one seed, you just won a series. You know, no, we'll keep trotting out the lineup we have. No, he hasn't done that. We saw Mike Budenholzer put Mirotić into the lineup to get more shooting in and try to open up the floor. That one didn't pan out a lot because of Mirotić's early foul trouble.
Missed shots and
everything else, but we've seen that go on. Brad Stevens went away from the Baines-Horford duo and went to Marcus Morris.
I thought they would get smaller eventually, maybe as early as game 2. Most coaches, you've won all these games in a row. I thought changing that lineup was kind of a gutsy move. But the gutsy is the wrong word. It's only Aaron Baines. It's not like you're doing some, you know, Barry is a good player, but you know what I mean. But I thought that was, most coaches I think would err on the side of, this is working. Let's see how it works here.
And absolutely. If it, you know, I'm with you. I don't know if I'd call it gutsy. Yeah, I have a hard time with anything in sports being gutsy because we're playing games. So I don't usually go to those things. But I do agree with you that most people would not have changed. You just swept the first round, and you did it on the basis of your defense, not your offense. And the two best players on – the two best defensive players now on the Celtics, especially with Marcus Smart out, are Baines and Horford. And he took one of them out of the starting lineup. But I think it's been great for them. Even though they got blown out last night, I think it was a good move, and I think he'll stay with it in this series. And you're right. Baines is going to have a hard time guarding Giannis, though in game one, he was okay against him because they kept their defense packed in and got a second body in front of him. I thought they started well containing Giannis off the dribble last night. But then, and every team's going to go through this, Milwaukee started knocking down threes, and people started cheating out more and more and more. And that was tough even on Al Horford, let alone Aaron Baines. If you're not going to be have your defense packed in, Aaron's not going to have a chance to play Giannis and contain him without fouling him.
I would like the Bucks. I get a little queasy when Ilyasova's out there. I just get a little queasy. They get a little too slow for me. I like when I would lean in a little bit more to Giannis and Mirotić as the only big men on the floor. Give me Bledsoe, Middleton, Giannis, Mirotić. And this is where the loss of Brogdon really hurts because you don't have the other guy. But maybe George Hill, I think, is playing pretty well, especially on defense. I like what the way they look there. You do risk a little bit on the glass. But like you said, the Celtics aren't going up there and destroying you on the glass. You get a little smaller. I get it. I like when Giannis and Mirotić are out there without Lopez and Ilyasova. To me, if Lopez gets played to the point that his minutes decline, I like that look for them.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm a little biased because I coached Ersan, not for long, but I think Ersan, again, the Bucks are a team that, you know, they're good at both ends of the floor, but they're the number one defense in the league. I think Mike looks to that, and Ersan's a very, very good team defender. We saw him take the charge last night. He's always going to give up his body. And regardless of what's gone on this year with him not taking as many threes or making them, he's still a guy that's a threat. And so people are still going to play him when he's on the floor and give him space. But you bring up a great point with Milwaukee. What's really been underplayed there is the loss of Brogdon. You know, they're going in and not nearly to the level, but when you combine it with the loss of Tony Snell, who was the guy they put in the starting lineup when Brogdon first went down, their depth is greatly depleted. And has made them play bigger probably more than they would like to.
Yeah,
simply because they don't have enough perimeter guys. Though I like Connaughton. I mean, he's been up and down, but I like him. He's a tough guy. He's athletic as hell and he can shoot the ball and he's not afraid to shoot it. I mean, give Mike Budenholzer credit for a lot of stuff this year, but they decided how they were going to play and those guys are going to let the threes fly all the time. I mean, they can miss 10 in a row and there's no hesitation.
Up in the first half.
Yeah, they're not concerned. I mean, they believe in the way they're going to play. Mike's given them confidence in that and it's worked out well for them.
Yeah, Connaughton, you just wish he could shoot it a little better. That's not fair. Like, I wish everyone could be a little better. I wish I were a little thinner. I wish it's not how it is, you know?
But you look at his shot and it's good. That's just it. You know, I watch him shoot and I'm like, man, that ball should be going in, you know. And so I think you do expect more, you know. It's not one of those. Like Giannis, he made a couple last night. You watch that shot and you're going, yeah, that's not going to go in very often. You know, Baines, they let shoot threes. I'm like, that's not
Baines is doing
going
some little
in.
Dance step with his feet.
Yeah,
on
well,
those
he always
threes,
does. Yeah, he's traveling basically, you know. But you don't expect it. But then you watch Connaughton, and I think he gets good balance. He's straight up and down on most of those. He's got, you know, a good, powerful base. His release looks good. You're just wondering why the ball doesn't go in more than it does.
And Snell, to be clear, is healthy. He played garbage time last night, but he had that late-season ankle, I think, maybe. And it's like one of those late-season things where you kind of fall out of the rotation. Maybe you can't do as much conditioning. And then it's like, well, now it's the playoffs. Like,
well, and that's going to be the question with Brogdon even.
Yeah.
As good as he is, he's going to have been out for so long. Like in the regular season, inserting somebody back in, and it happens all the time. It actually hurts you for four or five games while that guy's coming back in because He's not playing real well. You're out of a rhythm. Now you're going to put him into a – let's say he's ready in this series. You know, and you're going to throw him into a 2-2 series in game five. You know, that it's not easy, and I think that's where whenever it is – with Brogdon, as good as he is, that's where I think Mike is going to have a tough decision.
What did Jameer Nelson have in the 2009 finals? Was it a shoulder he was coming back
well,
from?
Well, yeah, and he had been out a long
and
time.
And Rafer Alston was your
Yeah,
name.
And Rafer had played well, and we had played well. Not nearly as we had played well as we had played early in the year. I want to say we were like 33-8 or something in the first half of the year. And that was a very difficult decision for us. And we didn't bring him back in the starting lineup. We brought him back off the bench. What we had actually started to do is, to be honest, is Anthony Johnson had backed up Rafer in the first half. And in the second half, we basically have games going down a stretch. We played Turkoglu as our backup point guard. But the one thing Turk wasn't going to be able to do against them, particularly against Lamar Odom, is break down the defense and get in the paint. We had won both games against the Lakers in the regular season, and it had been almost entirely because of Jameer Nelson. He had played great. We decided to play him as our backup. I've been questioned on that a million times since. I'm around Orlando, especially locally, like a lot of people, I got a lot of criticism. Well, yeah, look.
They don't say thank you for the finals birth?
No, of course they do. And they're more appreciative than anything. But I do get asked about that, and I got criticized for it. But it's one of those things, like, you know, listen, the one thing you have to be comfortable with as a coach is it's all about the result. There's nothing else that matters. I mean, I remember playing the Celtics the year we went to the finals, and we actually lost game five at home to go down 3-2. And the last play of that game, and we had talked about this going into the series, we're not going to let – they didn't have Garnett. Mm-hmm. We didn't have Jameer. And we're not going to let Paul Pierce beat us. And so we knew late in the game what we were going to do on any of those plays – any pick and roll, we're blitzing Paul Pierce. We're staying home on Ray Allen, and somebody else has to make a shot. And Big Baby Davis, who we ended up coaching later, hits a shot to beat us. And after the game, I get asked, you know, was it right move? I said, absolutely not. You can't say that I made the right move, but it didn't work. It ended up being the wrong move because it's a results-oriented business. But if I had it to do over again, I would do exactly the same thing. But your job, and some coaches are not comfortable with this. I always have been. Your job is to make the decision that works, because what matters at the end of the day is that you have to win. And you just have to accept that. That doesn't mean that you say to yourself, I would do it differently. But when you're talking to the public, you can't go out there and say, it's the right decision. It didn't work. It didn't end up being the right decision. But give me another playoff game or any game at the end of the game, I either get Paul Pierce shooting the ball or I get Big Baby Davis shooting the ball from 15 feet. I'm going with Big Baby.
Fair. Do you still have visions of the Courtney Lee layup that, like, in your nightmares or dreams?
I really don't, because I don't, because it was a difficult shot.
For younger people, this is game one of the 2009 finals.
Game two. We got destroyed in game one.
Right. And the game is tied, and you designed a beautiful side out of bounds play, and Courtney Lee gets an alley-oop. As you said, contested and kind of flying out of bounds. It's not like it's a dunk, you know?
Yeah, no, we were actually down two, so it would have tied it and brought it into overtime.
I thought it was the other way around.
And we didn't get it. Look, what I liked about the play was, and Turkoglu was the best inbounder I've ever had in those situations.
I'm looking at it right now. It's tied.
Okay, maybe it was.
I got it up.
Well, then you're up.
88-88.
There you go. And it's a very difficult shot, but Turk had the guts to make that pass. You got to have somebody out of bounds.
Yep.
A lot of guys are going to look at that play and go, to hell with it. I'm going to throw the ball to the guy coming off for the jump shot. Turk made the pass. It's as good a shot as you can hope to get.
Yeah, there's 0.6 seconds left in the game.
Yeah, there's as good a shot as you can hope to get. But Courtney certainly didn't deserve any criticism on that. It's not like he, you know, when it first came out, as, oh, we missed a layup. Well, that is hardly a layup. That's a really difficult shot. And Courtney's was a good athlete, but certainly not an overwhelming athlete. As a matter of fact, by NBA standards, probably an average athlete. So it was a tough shot.
Did that play have a name, and had you used it before?
We had worked on it. We had used it, but we'd never made that pass before.
Interesting. The other pass is to Redick here at the top of the key.
Yes. Okay. And we had never made that pass. So, you know, I mean.
Never made. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, so it, again, though, having the right inbounder in those late game situations, whether it's to get a shot or to just be able to inbound in certain situations, you got to have the right guy, because there's a lot of guys there that want to play it safe, and you take yourself out of opportunities.
Speaking of inbound, guarding the inbounder, you and I were texting about this a few weeks ago. What do you remember about the LeBron buzzer beater from the conference finals that year? It was game two, I think. You were up 1-0 in Cleveland.
Yeah.
Cleveland was the number one seed. LeBron hits this buzzer beater to win the game.
Well, what I remember, and this is a real – I wish that my memory didn't work this way, but I think it's a coach's memory, is I remember all the negative stuff and only very little of the positive stuff. And so what I remember there is we were up game one. We had made major comebacks in both of those games on the road against Cleveland. Like, we were down 20 in the first half of both of those games and had come back. And so we're up two on the shot LeBron makes, and this doesn't happen all the time. We actually had prepared for the play they ran.
Really?
And talked about it in the huddle. Like, we had an idea on the late. So what Mike Brown used to like to do on that play is they would go to pin down for LeBron, and he would start up hard and then try to back cut to the rim, and they threw the lob. They had gotten that on Indiana earlier in the year. I mean, that was the play in a low clock situation. So we were locked in. Turkaloo was locked in on the play. We had talked about it. He did such a good job of taking away the layup. Then LeBron had to come up. So he tried to get the back door, couldn't get it, comes up.
You're right. He does try. I'm watching
he
right
tries
now.
He, to
he,
get
he
the,
cuts right into his
yes,
chest almost.
Well, we knew exactly what was coming. And then he came up and ends up the three to beat us. And so I remember everything about the play. What we should have done in a low clock situation is we should have been tracking LeBron with the guy on the inbounder, knowing that Turkaloo was going to do his job and take away the lob. So we didn't need great pressure on the ball and been there to make the pass to LeBron tough. We didn't do that. And what bothered me about it is we had a chance to go up 2-0. That could have been a play that ended up costing us the series and a coaching decision. And that's how I felt about it right afterwards, that I just pissed away the best opportunity we were going to have to go to the NBA Finals. Now, it ended up that what we pissed away was a chance to sweep that series, because we played really well the rest of the series. But it's funny, in a series that we won, that play sticks with me. I can't name you anything else specifically on a play that happened in that series, and I remember that.
What's the locker room like after that? Do you say something? Do you need to say something? Did you fly out of Cleveland back to Orlando that night and just let everyone chill on the plane? Like, what do you do in a moment like that?
We did. Look, for me, it's tough. I just made sure everybody knew that our execution down the stretch, both offensively to take the lead and defensively on that play, was exactly what we had set up. I told them what we should have done and would do in that kind of situation again, and that it was my mistake, and we moved on. And so I was I was really down after that. You know, you go up 2-0 on the road, I mean, it's going to be
tough
to beat you. And we had played well against Cleveland for the 2 years that I had been in Orlando up to that time anyway. But you know what? Our guys, players are a lot better bouncing back than coaches anyway, in my opinion. And our guys, what they took from that series is we're just better than this team. They needed a miracle shot to get one game at home against us. We're better than they are. And they went with great confidence into game three and then game four. So my perspective was not their perspective, thankfully.
That statistically is one of LeBron's two or three best series ever. 38-9-9, I think he put up in that series.
Yeah, no, he was fabulous, but you know, part of that was our plan, and so blame it on me. But all the times that I had coached against LeBron, particularly at that point in his career, we always chose to try to make him score the ball rather than pass it, you know. And, you know, our feeling was that the only way that those other guys had enough to beat us over a seven-game series, at least we hoped, was if LeBron just created wide open looks for them and they could knock down shots, and we wanted to take that away. And so we played the entire series on him one-on-one. I don't think – we helped, obviously, on drives, but there was not a time in that game where we double-teamed him, blitzed him on a pick and roll, any of that. You know, you put two guys on the ball against him, and he's just – he's a genius. He's going to pick you apart, and we didn't want – want that to happen. And you know, we gave him not gave him we tried our best, but we ended up giving him a lot of points in that series.
Let's go back real quickly to Warriors Rockets. What do you do with Clint Capella if you're Mike D'Antoni? I watched the games, and I don't think Clint Capella is playing bad. I think obviously he's having some trouble finishing around the rim. He got bailed out by a couple bad foul calls on Durant last night. I thought Durant's rim protection was fantastic. Golden State's doing all sorts of crazy rim protection stuff on defense. Great stuff. Defensively, I think 8 out of 10 times he's doing the switch and ball denial and all that pretty well. Yeah, Steph's going to burn him every once in a while, hit a floater, his step. It's going to happen. I think he's playing pretty well. I've also always just thought in my gut, the Rockets are not going to win 4 games in this matchup if Capella becomes a bit player. They just are not going to have enough rim protection. Golden State's going to cut them to death. It's just he just adds a vertical dimension that they will not have if they go Tucker at center for 30 minutes a game. And yet, both last season and this season, the numbers just keep spitting back. They're getting destroyed with Capella on the floor. I think they're where do I have it? Minus 36 in 60 minutes with Capella on the floor, plus 26 in the other 36 minutes. The numbers are starting to make a pretty strong case against me over 2 seasons. I still just don't think those Tucker at center, they're so small now.
Yeah,
what do you do?
Numbers, you know, but we're talking the numbers are a, you know, a now 9-game sample size. And the numbers from the regular season over the last 2 years, which is also a small sample size, obviously, 8 games, that's not the case. Capella's been effective. And so I'm with you at both ends of the floor. Like, if you don't have the Clint Capella roll to the rim lob threat in your game, how are you creating, you know, enough shots? And then what you talked about with the defense at the other end with rim protection. The only thing about the rim protection is it gets negated a lot because of their switching.
You switch everything, right.
And so Capella's not protecting the rim. He's out on the floor guarding the shooter, which is also one of the big reasons that the Warriors have been able to wear out the Rockets on the boards.
And this is how they play centers off the floor. We're taking away what you do defensively because our shooting is so dangerous. You're not near the basket. And then offensively, we're just not going to guard you, and we're going to have our unbelievably good help defenders be there at the right time.
Yeah, no, and look, if you go back to game one, so the sort of, to me, the key possession in the game, the play that put it away was Steph Curry's 3 on Nene. And if you remember what happened, the Rockets were playing small at that point and playing well, okay, going into that stretch. They had given up offensive rebounds on 2 straight possessions. So now, with Houston at the free throw line, Mike D'Antoni brings Nene back in the game because of the rebounding. But the rebounding doesn't even end up becoming a factor because they switch the pick and roll. It's Steph Curry on Nene, and, you know, he's just able to get space, and he pulls up and hits a 3, even if he'd missed. Nene's not going to help him rebound the ball. He's out at the three-point line. And I think that's one of the great ways, and the Warriors have done as good a job as anybody, but one of the great ways to attack all the switching that's going on in the NBA is make the big defend the guard, get up a reasonable shot, and then attack the glass because they're small inside and you've got advantages on the offensive board. And so it's not just the post up where you've got the size advantage inside. You've got the size advantage on the boards. And the Warriors have really taken advantage of that in this series. I think it's one of the sort of underrated things in this series in where the switching has hurt Houston.
I'm going to read you a stat, and I want you to tell me what I should make of this stat. All right? This is the number of ball screens for James Harden per 100 possessions when the Rockets are on offense. Number of ball screens for Harden. Regular season, 47 per 100 possessions. Utah series, 30 per 100 possessions. Two games against Golden State, 79 per 100 possessions. So like 2.5 times the frequency. Why is that? What's happening there?
Well, I think what they're trying to do, and the Warriors have done a little bit of both. They're either trying to put two guys on the ball, on Harden, to create shots, which the Warriors have done some of, or force a switch onto a more favorable
Curry
matchup. Correct. But Curry, they're not switching. He's been forced to a couple of times on rescreens. But when Curry's guy comes up, Curry's showing and giving his guy a chance to get over, and he's done a damn good job of it.
And Andre, I was going to ask you, why do you think they're not getting the switch? Because Andre has also been great. And I also just – well, you nailed it. When Austin Rivers last night, started rescreening, started flipping it around,
yeah,
they started to get switches finally. And I just wonder, like, do they not have good enough – like, I'm trying to figure out why can't they get the Curry switch, because they can't get it. Part of it is Golden State, but I think part of it is they're not screening well enough. And Austin Rivers, of all people, I think started setting really good second screens.
Well, they did a lot of it with the Clippers with his dad. A lot of flipping the screens. He's really good at it. And yeah, that's a tough, you know, Curry's showing and doing a good job of that. When you flip the screen, you get caught on the wrong side and you get forced into that switch. And that's been a difficult thing with them. You know, it'll be interesting to see Houston going forward. Because they've also run into some shot clock problems, more so in game one than game two. If they don't just come down and go quicker, with Harden on the ices and let him just go, and create on his own, certainly takes away being able to put two guys on the ball initially. It certainly takes away, shot clock problems. But Houston, let's face it. I mean, Mike D'Antoni has done a great job of, to me, getting a lot of offensive production out of, I mean, I don't want to put anybody down, but it's not a great roster. You've got a Chris Paul that's nowhere near peak Chris Paul. Your next best player is Eric Gordon.
And who's then playing? Who's playing? Phenomenal, by the way.
And then everybody else is really limited. And so they've played basically pick and roll for James Harden, isolation for James Harden. There's not like a lot of stuff there.
No.
I was talking to my brother the other night and we were saying, like, what's the walkthrough? Like 5 minutes? Like, these are the two things they're going
to
run.
To stand through. For most of the guys, it's a stand through.
Yeah, there it is. Like, what are we doing? Where are we helping? But there's not a lot of, other than out of timeouts, there's not a lot of stuff that you've got to prepare for.
See, I think in a weird way, and I wrote about this during the Utah series, I think Harden has almost gotten more comfortable going one-on-one than he is on the pick and roll.
Well, I agree. He doesn't see the second defender. Or if he does, it's late. It's after he's beaten his man and the help comes. That's a lot easier to read and pass out of. They had, the one where Clay made the great rotation and steal last night on the lob. That's two guys on the ball on Harden. You know, that type of thing doesn't really give Harden as good a chance to attack as if he just goes one-on-one. And I'm going to be interested to see in game three if we don't just see more straight isolation from Harden and give him a chance to go.
I think the same thing, and the Utah series, the first two games really highlighted, he likes to just put the chess pieces where he wants. So Clint Capella, you go in the right dunker spot, right under the rim. We're going to put one shooter on your side of the floor, two shooters on the left side. I'm going to beat my guy. and here's what's going to happen. Your guy's going to step up onto me.
Exactly right.
I'm either going to lob to you, or the guy who's guarding the one shooter on your side is going to come guard you, and I'm going to hit him for a wide open three. There's nothing you can do about that except just be better. And so the Warriors are bigger, smarter, longer, faster, and they're doing things like that exact setup. There was a couple plays last night when instead of having Capella's guy move at all, they just brought Draymond Green over from the other side of the floor off of PJ Tucker and said, the only pass we're giving you is the backhanded lefty pass to PJ Tucker above the break, because we're just going to live with PJ Tucker
shooting. Absolutely.
And he made a couple to his credit. But and even when they don't do that sort of unconventional help from all the way across the floor, they're just better at timing their rotations and being like, Kevin Durant is huge in the passing lane. And I think Houston has kind of gotten a little spooked out of playing that one-on-one game because the Warriors are just better at taking it away.
Well, and again, you don't have a lot of different situations. So you sort of know what you're going to see, but either the pick and roll or the isolation, and you know what the options are. And Draymond's been great on, you know, he's picked off a couple of lobs, deflected them. He reads Harden what he's doing really well.
He's the best I've ever seen. I don't know how he tricks people into
throwing. Nah, he's fantastic.
He jumps at you. He feints at you. You throw the lob. The ball's still in your hands, and he's already on the way back to tip the lob. It's uncanny.
No, it really is. And then, you know, Durant's length, and my brother's been talking about it for two series now, but he's absolutely right. Durant's a very underrated defender who's put a lot into that. We know how good Klay is.
Klay doesn't get it. Klay is an absolute – I don't mean this as a disparaging thing, but, like, Curry's injuries become this, like – Let me. We're gonna watch every drive like with Zapruder level intensity to figure out, is he at 90% mobility? How's this change of direction? Klay hasn't even. We don't even hear about Klay's ankle anymore. It's already in the past. That dude is such a stud. He's such an Iron Man. He complains about nothing. He'll play through anything. He's just an absolute stud.
No, he really is, and deserves more credit than he gets. But a little bit like we talked with Al Horford. I mean, if you want to talk about. As good as some of those other guys are, the guy who anchors that defense and makes it go is still Draymond Green.
Where are you going to be? Are you here for another day? Where are we going to see you on ESPN's and ABC's programming coming up?
You know what? The only thing I have left scheduled for the rest of the year is, you know, I'm here on Get Up tomorrow, and that's it. And then I don't know because, you know, I got a couple of chances on Countdown at the start of the playoffs because Chauncey was out doing games.
Mm-hmm.
But I think their crew's pretty well intact now going forward with Paul and Jalen and Chauncey there with Michelle. So I don't think I'll be back out there. I think this is pretty well it for me tomorrow. And then we're into the off season and I can just enjoy the games like everybody else.
Well, that's a sad note to end on. Now I'm sad.
You've
been a very welcome presence on television. I like it.
I've enjoyed it. But you know what? Now I can just record the games and I don't need to stay up all night and get 3 hours sleep to come in and talk about the games at 6 a.m. So I'm fine with that.
Well, I was going to say, if you're coming back here, I want to grab a beer and watch a game with you because I want to see. Like, I'm sure the stuff I'm seeing when I rewind the game, it's like you're five levels of chess ahead of me. I want to watch a game with somebody like you and say, did you see that, that, and that? Be like, what the hell just happened? Like, you point that out to me.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Again, I think that there's times that – and look, I mean, there's a lot of schematic stuff that goes on, but I don't think it's quite at the level. And Brad Stevens said this the other day, and he's absolutely right. Like – it's not quite at the level everybody thinks. It's pretty simple stuff. I mean, it really is. It's so, you know, if you went into Boston's game plan, from what I'm seeing, their big game plan is run back early and fast and get in front of Giannis.
That's their biggest part of the game. Dribbling.
Yes, that's been their big thing. And then if you look on the other side, and what does Milwaukee try to do? Well, they're switching a little bit more. And we're going to help really early on Kyrie. I mean, it's really like enforcing simple principles and trying to get guys, you know, to do them better and pay attention to detail than some really complicated thing. Like, I don't see anything close to the Jordan rules that Detroit used to have, you know, based on where he caught the ball and all of that. I'm not seeing it right now. I'm not saying coaches aren't capable of it. That's not what I'm seeing. I'm not seeing that level of complexity right now.
No, it's funny you say that because that's step three over Nene at the end of that game. I believe if you go back and watch the matchups, they had Tucker on Curry for the first time all game and Harden on Durant. And I think they were trying to put themselves in position to switch that play and have Tucker end up on Durant. And like all this complex machination is going on. And all the Warriors, it is like, where's Nene?
Who's got
Nene on him? Bring him up.
And that's what we're seeing. And I'm not sure this part is good for the NBA because, you know, you see Portland in Denver. That series is going to be pretty good, as was the Denver San Antonio series in terms of seeing more player movement.
Yes.
And the ball moving. But, you know, Golden State Houston, that is a pick and roll isolation series. I mean, you're
was
not.
Was last year too.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's really more of what you're seeing across the league than anything else. And I think that's going to become a little bit of a challenge going forward. I could be wrong. But I know I look at it and I don't find it exciting to watch guys just standing behind the three-point line shooting the ball. I mean, that's basically what I can see at a pickup game at the YMCA, just with a lot higher level players. Like when I think the NBA, I'm thinking of these guys' athleticism, their decision-making. I'm thinking plays at the rim, the help's coming. Can I finish over the guy? Can I make the pass? And now every team, you know, has basically got two guys just standing in the corner who don't do much of anything. And then we're either seeing an isolation or a pick and roll. I don't know. I think the league tends to look at it and say, well, there's more points being scored. Number of points on the board to me is not what makes a game exciting. And some of the threes are exciting. Steph Curry, exciting. To me, Harden step backs, that's different. But the guy who just spots up in the corner and or even out top, Brook Lopez, and stands and shoots it, it's effective, not exciting. Like the Bucks made 23s last night. The exciting plays are Giannis going to the basket.
Yep.
Everything else, like, really? I mean, I feel like sometimes I'm watching a suburban high school game somewhere, you know, and a guys who played like me standing around shooting the ball. And believe me, not exciting.
Does the NBA have a slogan anymore? I love this game. Is it I love this game? Remember, there's the NBA that it's fantastic.
Yeah, was
how
that.
How about the NBA, like your suburban high, just like your suburban high school game, only better, more athletic.
And a lot better shooters and certainly the talent you can appreciate. And the one thing it has done for the league is because it's hard to score in a half court, we've seen it speed up. And I think that's good.
That's true.
But it slows down again in the playoffs. And I'm just not sure, for as much talent as we have in this league and as much greatness as we have, that our games are as exciting as they could be. You know, but again, sometimes, you know, as people say to me, are we just being the old guys with the get off my lawn stuff, and the game is as good as it's ever been?
That's what I wonder, actually. I had Kurt Goldsberry on my podcast yesterday because he has a book that addresses all of these things.
Yeah. And talking about the solutions and the,
And I thought to myself, you know, I wonder, the 15-year-old fan has never seen anything but this. This is what they're going to grow up on. I just wonder if they're just going to say, well, that's basketball. That's just how it is. I don't remember a day when there was all this kind of fancy stuff going on. But there is enough still, as you said, you mentioned Denver and Portland. There's still enough stylistic diversity around that they will be exposed to that. But there is just a lot of that. I mean, Kirk even proposed – this wasn't in the piece that ran on ESPN. He proposes a 3-second violation in the corners, that you can't stand in the corners for more than 3 seconds. Now, you might need another freaking ref to oversee that.
Yeah.
I don't know. But
and I hate it when we have to contrive things. But I do know, like when I came in the league as an assistant, you know, and we all tend to exaggerate as time goes on. I understand that. But there would be at least 3 or 4 plays. I was going to say 6 to 8, but I'll cut it back knowing – my propensity to exaggerate the olden days, but 3 to 4 plays a night at the rim where these great athletes are going to the rim and the shot blocker is coming because not everybody was playing with 6-7 centers at the time. And we're going to get a play at the rim. And I just remember, you know, I'm coming from 14 years as a college coach into the NBA and sitting there every night, like three or four times a night going, holy crap, are these guys unbelievable? And just thinking that in my head. And now you get a 2-on-1, 3-on-2 fast break and nobody attacks a basket. It's going to be throwing it to a three. Like there's nothing, there's not, a, not nothing. But there's not as much going to the rim. There's a few guys. I mean, you're going to get Giannis, and there's a few guys. But everything else is we're just going to throw it out and shoot the ball. And it's – to me, I don't think it's as good as it could be. I think the players are better than ever, more skilled than ever, more athletic than ever. And yet I don't think our game is as – is reflecting that.
This is why we all need to root as neutral people for the Nuggets to stay good, for this weird Philly experiment of Simmons and Embiid. I want it to work just because I want something that looks so different. They run no pick and roll. They have the most unstoppable post-up player in the whole league. I want that to work. And Towns in Minnesota, is he can do everything offensively, but he's unguardable in the post. I want – those are guys are like the hope for some stylistic diversity going forward. Like, yo, you mentioned Denver – people are starting to realize, like, Denver's been fun to watch for a long time now. They're really fun. The way the Jokic plays and all the motion around him, it's just, it's different. The ball starts at the elbow and it moves to the side and then comes back to the elbow, moves over here, then it's under the rim. It's just fun to watch.
Well, it is. And look, here's the one thing. I think even with our analytics, one of the things we have to sort of do is, or not do, is not assuming that regular season analytics hold up in the playoffs, because we are seeing in the playoffs the return of the mid-range game. If we go from the restricted area out to the arc and we look at the most efficient offensive teams in the playoffs, they're the teams that are taking more mid-range shots than other people by and large. Not Milwaukee of the best teams, but everybody else. Golden State, ton of mid-range shots. Denver, ton of mid-range shots. Philly, a lot of mid-range shots. And those are the most efficient offensive teams in the league. So what we're seeing in the playoffs is what works is get to the free throw line and make your mid-range shots. Now, it's not because those shots are necessarily more preferable, but defenses have time to prepare. And they're doing a better job of taking away the high-percentage shots, and they're leaving you with that. And then we look at Kevin Durant, the leading scorer in the playoffs right now. Kevin Durant, 55% of his shots are twos from 4 feet to the arc. He's not getting many layups. He is shooting quite a few threes, but not anywhere near like a Damian Lillard. Sure. He's living in the mid-range and the off-the-post type of stuff, and he's the leading scorer in the league. Now, there's not too many guys going to be as efficient on those shots as Kevin Durant, but we're seeing it on a little bit lesser level with Kawhi Leonard. A lot of mid-range pull-ups. And so maybe what works in the regular season isn't necessarily what works in the playoffs. And we're seeing Houston struggle, not just James Harden, okay? So they have a first-round series with Utah, or, you know, obviously a good defensive team. But they have not been very efficient offensively so far in the playoffs, and they're a team that is shooting nothing but layups and threes.
Well, in part because Harden's floater has mysteriously deserted him. It was a shot that he made a lot of hay on in the regular season, and he can't make it right now.
No, that's exactly right. And so the only team that's having offensive success so far in the playoffs that is where the analytics would put us in terms of shot selection is Milwaukee. But everybody else, it's sort of different right now. It's free throws and mid-range jumpers are working. Oh, mid-range jumpers, runners, post-ups, floaters, that stuff's working right now. So there's a sense of hope, too, is maybe what you need to do in the most important part of the year is to play a little differently than what everybody's telling you during the year. And part of it is, too, let's face it, you know, we've both seen the playoffs for a long time. Closeouts are harder. There's more pressure and more contests on shooters. And so those threes are not the threes you're getting all the time in a regular season, at least not every night. Like last night, Milwaukee did get great threes. But they also had some just pull-up contested threes. Middleton had a couple of just like jab step, get the guy off you shot. Those are tough shots, you know. And there's a lot of mid-range stuff open. And so what we have known for a long time still will hold true. The guys that can score at every level are the guys that are really, really good because they can adjust to what the defense is giving them. So Durant obviously can get to the rim. He doesn't do it a lot, but can get to the rim if he has to. He can make all the mid-range stuff and post-up stuff, and he can shoot the three. Kawhi, the same thing. Those are the guys that are going to have great, great success at the biggest times of the year.
And to your point, playoffs, you play the best defenses, and they make you play the shot clock. Sometimes you're just not going to get a better shot than the 12-footer with 11 on the shot clock. You better take it.
Well, and I think that what it says to us as coaches is even if you're in a place that, you know, wants to shoot nothing but free throws, layups, and threes, you know, Milwaukee, Houston, Portland to a degree, you know, even if that's where you are, you've got to still work on all those pull-ups because, like you said, sometimes that's the shot you're going to end up with against the best defenses, and your ability to make that shot, at least have a couple people who can make those shots, is going to be the difference between winning and losing in the playoffs.
All right, Coach, go take a nap. You need a nap.
I'm going to do that.
Go take a nap. Stan Van Gundy, it's just a pleasure talking to you. You know this game back and forth, and you've forgotten more today than any of us know about the game. So it's a pleasure to see you. Thanks for coming on the pod, and I'll look for you on Get Up, and I'll hope to see you somewhere else after that.
Thank you very much.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.